Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Here's the top story. A Mexican immigrant in Seattle, protected by the so-called Dreamer program, is now being held in a Tacoma detention center. This is believed to be the first arrest of its kind under President Trump. The man has filed a federal lawsuit in Seattle challenging his detention. Reporter Liz Jones with KUOW's immigration team has the story. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Bill.
First off, this man was arrested on Friday, and what happened?
Yeah, so this young man, his name is Daniel Ramirez Medina. He came to the U.S. when he was about 7 years old. He's been living in California, going to school. He's 23 years old now, and he recently moved up to Washington to live with his father. So what happened on Friday is that immigration agents came to his father's home south of Seattle with an arrest warrant for his father. His father had an order of removal from the country, which is not uncommon. He was known to ICE, and they came there to follow up on that order of removal. But what happened was they picked up Mr. Ramirez, Daniel Ramirez, as well. So what's unusual about this case is Mr. Ramirez has what's called DACA. This is Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. Mr. Ramirez received this DACA protection twice in 2014 and 2016. This is a program created under Obama to give some protections to people who came here as young children who have only known the U.S. as their home. They're in school, they've served in the military, they've passed a background check, they pose no risk to the U.S. So when immigration agents then went to arrest Mr. Ramirez, he told them, I have DACA. Look, here's my work permit. They apparently knew that, but in the court documents, they say that ICE agents knew Ramirez had this DACA, but they told him he would be detained and deported anyway because he was, quote, not born in this country.
That seems like a contradiction. He was protected, although he was not born in this country, but that's what they said. Well, let's get, what is ICE's, this is the Federal Immigration Authority, what are they saying about why they chose to arrest this man?
So Mr. Ramirez has been in detention in Tacoma since Friday. On Tuesday evening, 4 days later, they came out with ICE released a statement saying that they arrested Mr. Ramirez because of a, quote, gang affiliation and risk to public safety. Mr. Ramirez's attorneys refute that claim. They say he's never been convicted of a crime. He's not a part of a gang, and that he was pressured by immigration agents to falsely admit an affiliation. Now, with the DACA program, gang affiliation is grounds for the government to deny your application or deny renewal of it or take it away. But what's why this is getting headlines is this is the first known DACA arrest under President Trump. And it's happened before Trump was in office, but these cases have been removed quickly. There's even a hotline that Department of Homeland Security maintains for DACA recipients to call if they've been falsely or wrongly arrested to say, hey, I have DACA, and they've promptly been released after that.
So this is the big question, Liz. We have a new president. There are hundreds of thousands of people here who are protected by this Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, this DACA program. We've met many of them on KUOW, and they're wondering, what does this arrest mean for those people?
This case is likely to get widespread attention and raise some concerns because of President Trump's position on DACA and the uncertainty around that going forward. During the campaign, we heard Trump vow to end the DACA program. He later backed off that after the inauguration, saying we'll work something out for these young people. And attorneys for Mr. Ramirez have hit a cautious note saying, don't panic to all these DACA recipients. This is not a harbinger of a policy change. They believe it's an isolated case, a unique situation where this individual was perhaps mistakenly picked up by ICE. And just one more piece that we should mention is President Trump's recent executive orders. There's one that deals directly with priorities for enforcement, priorities for deportation, and it sets out some new guidelines on that. Nothing specific to DACA, but two guidelines in particular that could come into play here. One is a new priority for people who have committed acts that constitute a chargeable offense. So that's kind of drawing a new line. You haven't been charged, you haven't been convicted, but you've committed an act that might be chargeable. And there's another guideline in there in the executive order that says, in the judgment of an immigration officer, the person poses a risk to public safety. So that's putting the onus on the immigration officer rather than an immigration judge.
America is trying to figure out what all of this means. And meanwhile, Liz, we still have Mr. Ramirez here. And what happens next to him?
Well, he is still being held in the detention center in Tacoma. He has a hearing set for Friday in Seattle, in federal court in Seattle. And that's looking at his grounds of detention. His attorneys say that he wasn't given due process. It's an unlawful imprisonment. So that will be addressed in a courtroom on Friday here in Seattle. Meanwhile, his case will proceed, his deportation case will proceed through an immigration court with a different judge. So two different tracks there, and we'll see which direction they go.
KUOW reporter Liz Jones with our immigration team. Thanks for the update, Liz.
Thank you, Bill.
NPR is also focusing on the story of this Seattle man, and you will hear that coverage later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Reports of these raids by federal immigration agents have people in eastern Washington on edge. Correspondent Emily Schwing says what started as a rally in support of immigrants and refugees on Sunday ended in a wild goose chase at Spokane's bus station.
More than 1,500 people gathered for the rally. Some were immigrants, but the majority were there to show their support for Spokane's refugee population. They filled a ballroom at Gonzaga University to capacity and still flooded the hallway and the stairwell outside. A handful of speakers from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia shared personal stories and sang. Local leaders tried to reassure immigrants who fear they might be targeted for deportation. But then City Council President Ben Stuckert announced he just received a report that ICE, the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, was raiding Spokane's bus and train station.
And I was feeling really bad because I was on my phone for the last half hour while people were talking. And that's because ICE was actually just at the Intermodal Center, which is owned by the city, doing checks on IDs of people.
A day after the rally, he sent a text message. In retrospect, I should have verified before I spoke, he wrote. But the information Stuckert shared at the rally was enough to convince civil rights activists and a few curious onlookers to visit the station, where a bus from Seattle destined for Missoula arrived at 4 p.m. No one on the bus said they'd had their ID checked by a federal agent. Letitia Conto is the development director at Spokane Center for Justice. She says activists who reported seeing agents from ICE could have mistaken them for Customs and Border Protection officers. But the mistake wasn't corrected before reports spread across social media, creating what Conto described as potential hysteria.
So if you hear that ICE is doing raids in your town, you want to be really certain that that's true information, because otherwise you're scaring people.
City Councilman and attorney Brian Beggs also made a trip to the bus station, chasing the rumor of a raid in Washington's second largest city.
And so the worry is, how big is that going to be? And are they using city property to accomplish that goal? That's why I came to see if that was happening. I've seen no evidence of it.
At 5 o'clock, another bus pulled in. It had come by way of Vancouver, British Columbia, and then Seattle before it stopped in Spokane. A Customs and Border Protection agent appeared but left without asking for anyone's ID. Any bus that comes through Spokane from Canada has already stopped in Seattle, 280 miles west, so it's unclear why Customs and Border Protection would check buses and trains a second time. In an email, a spokesperson says the agency carries out regular checks because Spokane is the nearest major transportation hub south of the Canadian border. According to federal law, immigration officers can board any vehicle without a warrant within a reasonable distance of the U.S. border. That distance is defined in the Immigration and Nationality Act as 100 air miles. Depending on where you are in Spokane, the Canadian border is between 92 and 107 miles north. Local law enforcement only works in coordination with federal agencies by request. The Department of Homeland Security did not return calls or an email to confirm if ICE operations took place in eastern Washington over the weekend. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke with some great news for Sounders fans. All-star forward Clint Dempsey is back after missing the end of last season because of an irregular heartbeat. Remember that even without Dempsey, the Sounders won their first championship. So now that he's back, surely they can start making more room in the trophy case, right? Well, Steve Clare says Maybe not. He's the owner and editor of the soccer news site Prost America. He says the Sounders might be better off without Dempsey.
I'm entering controversial water right from the start here, which is a tribute to how good you are at probing questions. But I kind of felt that Clint, either A, because of his health, or B, because of his attitude, wasn't quite giving his all for the side during the losing run. Now, at the time I was making those observations, I did not know about his illness. So I gave myself some leeway from being cruel on the guy. But really, without him, it would be hard to convince many people watching Sounders in the second half of the season. This is a team who have lost their best player, the guy that makes them tick, and this is a sticking plaster of an operation. Because they looked a thoroughly decent side in the second half of the season without the guy, which prompted many people to ask, if you have a winning team that's playing well, do you automatically shake things up when your highest paid player becomes more available?
So the coach has a puzzle to work out here, but are Sounders fans feeling pretty happy, excited right now with the return of Clint Dempsey?
Sounders fans were talking about this, and the reaction was, I wouldn't say euphoric, it was pleased, but that's now been all overshadowed by this morning's news that former beloved star Freddie Montero has gone to the Vancouver Whitecaps, and that has put the presence of Dempsey very much in the spotlight. Some fans are juxtaposing which of the two you would rather have, two to two played together, and I think more relevantly, are the amount of the resources that Sounders FC put into Clint Dempsey in a very high salary, what is that not freeing money up for? Could they have pursued Montero had they not had Clint on the wage bill? And some fans are saying, you know, of the two, I'd rather have Montero. So there's a healthy debate going on out there.
Right. Maybe we could have got Freddie Montero back. Finally, Steve, Sounders are the champs. They won the MLS Cup. For the first time, the champs visit the White House. That's how it goes. So are the Sounders going to be giving President Trump a jersey?
Well, I think they might just cut out the middleman and go straight to the Kremlin. But seriously, it's also well known both Garth Lagerwey, the GM, Adrian Hanauer, the now majority owner, and Joe Ross, the former majority owner, they're all very prominent Democrats and outspoken Democrats. And, you know, we live in Seattle, and you know the soccer demographic. Hey, King County leans heavily to the left. Sounders support has a very solid core in North Seattle, which is even more left than normal Seattle. I think, and I'm told by the club there's been no invitation issued yet, I think Adrian Hanauer would breathe a huge sigh of relief if the invitation was never forthcoming. Because I don't think anybody, you know, in Seattle and in the soccer world really wants a photo to be taken with Donald Trump. So, but if the invitation does come, and, you know, the president doesn't take his unpopularity very seriously, I think the New England Patriots boycott, I think six so far, that will be nothing compared to the number of Sounders that don't want to go and be seen with this man. So, yeah, it's a story yet to happen. You and I in the media will love it. But I think there may be, in my gut, some casual conversations urging the White House not to issue the invitation.
Steve Clare owns and edits the soccer news site Prost America. And you can check out Prost America's book, the 2016/17 Women's Soccer Yearbook. We're tweeting out a link to that right now at KUOW. Rolling on with KUOW's The Record, our whole region is growing, but no place has plans to grow faster than Black Diamond, a tiny town in southeast King County. There are no freeways there, no light rail stops, and it's about to become home to what might be the largest development in King County history. Reporter Joshua McNichols from KUOW's Region of Boom team says this Oak Point development has divided the community of Black Diamond.
Marianne and Bill McDermott moved to Black Diamond 23 years ago for the peace and tranquility.
We like the fact that it's out in the country.
The trees and the just the nice forest areas.
And the strong sense of community.
Our kids used to play together and you just got along good with everybody.
Back then, most of the people liked Black Diamond the way it was. But developers had other ideas. Growth in Seattle, Renton, and Kent has meant more people looking for homes in southeast King County. The developer wanted to replace the forests around Black Diamond with 6,000 new houses that would quadruple the size of the town. It's turned neighbors against each other. the McDermans are dead set against the project.
People that used to be our friends, now we don't talk to. If you see somebody, say, for instance, at the post office that you used to, hi, how are you? Now we just walk right by them and and most of the time they won't speak to us.
Because those kinds of chance encounters can get ugly real fast.
Oh, some of the words that's been said is just unbelievable. I mean, I wouldn't make a sailor embarrassed to hear some of this stuff going around here. It's terrible.
But other people support the development. Even some who fought it for years have come to see the benefits of growth.
It's going to come whether we want it or not. We just embrace it.
That's Patrick Nelson, another Black Diamond resident. He says the development will be good for his town. The developer's brightly colored illustrations help make that case. They show young kids climbing on boulders on a green lawn in a common area between brand new homes. Everywhere in those pictures, people are outside, riding bikes, walking dogs, or just sitting at a cafe table enjoying the sunshine. That's how developers market the suburbs these days. The people in these pictures aren't just escaping the city. They're escaping into nature. Nelson says we need to welcome all those people in those promotional posters to Black Diamond, just like his family was welcomed into the small town community 14 years ago.
And with the development coming, they can still have that small town community feel, just more residents to enjoy.
But his support for the project gets him in trouble sometimes. At a local restaurant, someone called him names.
And I just laughed. I'm like, okay, buddy, have a good day. By the way, when the new development comes, please don't step foot on it because you don't like it.
Those deep divisions help explain how city council meetings often devolve into shouting matches between the mayor and council members on either side.
I am part of this council. I can vote.
I break the tie.
There is no tie. And this is between the council members, and your vote does not count.
There are two sides in this fight. On one side is the city council majority. They want to slow the developer down so the city doesn't get taken advantage of. On the other side is the mayor.
I'm Carol Benson, and I'm the mayor of Black Diamond.
She says the developer has a legal right to build this project.
It's a contract. They own the land.
But the city council majority has a strategy. It's turned the fight over the development into a fight over the city budget. Because whoever controls the purse strings controls oversight of the massive development. There's a crucial meeting to try to reach a compromise Thursday night. Mayor Benson says she'll probably have to start planning to shut down the government next week if the two sides can't reach an agreement.
You cannot run a city without a budget, period.
She says that means no water, no sewer, no building inspectors, and no police or firefighters.
There's never been a city that's gone through this in the state of Washington before. This is new. Nobody wants to touch us. They think it's all political infighting.
It's not my intention to have a city government shut down.
That's Black Diamond City Council member Brian Weber. Weber says he submitted a new version of the budget, which included more funding to watchdog the developer. But the mayor vetoed Weber's budget. So Weber says this whole shutdown thing is in the mayor's court now.
So as far as the city shutdown, the mayor's the only one that can make that call.
At this point, it doesn't seem like the two sides are getting any closer. The city council meetings are still a mess.
It's like a council meeting meets Jerry Springer. It's just ridiculous. And how do we get our city business done when there's just constant...
Don't just give me a dirty look. Answer the question.
I'm not giving you a dirty look.
We need a lawyer.
Excuse me, Mayor.
Order in the
gavel down.
Council.
Growth is an emotional topic. All over the region, people are having heated conversations about it. At the political level, most cities work out their differences without all the shouting and the drama. That's according to Jim Doherty of the Municipal Research and Services Center. It's a nonprofit research organization serving local governments in Washington. Both sides in this debate have asked his team for advice about how to resolve their intractable dispute.
We do sometimes see that type of a clash where people want to stake out their position and aren't willing to compromise. But compromise is the basis of all democratic government.
And he says when officials don't compromise, people eventually vote them out of office. In Black Diamond, the mayor and two city council members are up for re-election this fall. Meanwhile, on the edge of town, the developer is preparing for action. It scraped clean a giant patch of land and brought in job shacks and construction equipment and giant piles of gravel. Soon, there will be hundreds of new foundations on this land, then houses, then people, and officials who want to be elected or re-elected here will have a whole new set of doors to knock on. For KUOW's Region of Boom team, I'm Joshua McNichols in Black Diamond.
Our Region of Boom team will spend about a month in Black Diamond to find out how growth is affecting that community. And then what? Where should we go after that? Tweet at KUOW using the hashtag Region of Boom. It's The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. We are still waiting to see whether President Trump will rewrite his travel ban after losing the court battle to keep it in place. I'm talking about the executive order that restricted travel to the U.S. from seven majority Muslim nations and sent thousands of protesters to airports like SeaTac. Now we're going to meet somebody on the other end of the president's pen. Murtada Al-Tamimi is an Iraqi software engineer, 24 years old, and he works for Facebook here in Seattle. He told KUOW's Deborah Wong he found out about Trump's executive order just a few days before it was signed.
It was a Tuesday evening, and I was in Vancouver in Canada with my family. It was the opening night of my little brother's performances in the theater, and he's been working on this play all year. It's his first time being on a show, and we were all excited to go watch him in the play, and so I was getting ready to go, and then I got a call from the immigration attorney I work with, and it was unexpected for me to hear from her on that day. We weren't working on a specific application, and she said, "Where are you?" And I thought it was strange. I'm getting an unexpected call from an attorney saying, "Where are you?" And I said, "I'm in Vancouver for the evening with my family." And she said, "Okay, come back right now." And I was like, "Why?" I was shocked. And she said, "President Trump is expected to sign an order as early as tomorrow morning that would ban people from Iraq and a few other countries from entering the country." You know, we'd heard during the campaign that things like this might come down and it might change. And I don't understand how government works very well, but people reassured me that there are so many checks and balances in the system that one person can't change things so drastically and overnight. And so I was totally shocked because it was only day two for the administration. It was the second business day for the administration being in office. And yet this big change was already coming down the pipeline. So it was totally unexpected. I hadn't prepared for anything like that. And I was in a position where I had to decide whether I go back right away and miss out on my brother's play, or I stay and possibly risk not being able to come back in the country. So I thought about it and I decided there's no way I'm going to miss his performance. I missed out on a lot of his childhood, and I wanted to see this milestone. I wanted to be there for him. So
you stayed for the play.
I stayed.
And took a chance.
Yeah.
And so what happened the next morning? You got up and went to the airport?
Yeah. So I decided at least to be somewhat prudent that I would go to the airport early. You know, we're in Vancouver, so we're 3 hours behind Washington. And I was worried that maybe they signed it super early in the morning. So their 8 a.m. is our 5 a.m. So I went to the airport at 4 a.m., which was 5 hours before my flight. I didn't even need to go that early, but I wanted to clear immigration and make it into the country before anything could take effect. So I went to the airport, I made it through, and it was okay. But then it was the anticipation now and the anxiety of what's going to happen. Is this going to be signed? I had plans to be traveling out of the country again, going on a business trip to Africa, and then all of a sudden thinking of, do I have to cancel all these plans? And sure, it came down to that. I had to cancel everything and remain in the U.S. for the next few weeks.
Before we sort of continue on with the story, tell us a little bit about you. You're Iraqi. You came here when you were rather young on kind of an unusual program, which invited people from Muslim majority countries to come to the United States.
Yeah. So it's a very interesting and ironic situation, actually. So I came here 10 years ago. I was 15 years old. I came on an exchange program sponsored by the State Department. And the purpose of the program was to invite students from Muslim countries to the United States and have them live here with an American host family for a year to help bridge the gap that was created between the Muslim world and the West as a result of the 9/11 attacks. And this program works. I consider myself to be a success story of this program. I came here with very little understanding about America and what Americans were like. And I was placed in a community in small town Minnesota where people also knew very little about Iraq and where I came from. And so the mission of this program with my own journey was achieved, in my opinion, that I learned a great deal about American people, and the people in my community that I lived in Minnesota learned a great deal about Iraq. And there were misconceptions on both sides that were dissolved as a result of my exposure and my experience being here and the exposure that people from here had to me and my culture through the time I spent here.
And then you stayed on in the United States, went to college here?
I went to college in Canada, and then I came back. I did an internship with Facebook in 2012 in California. And then by the end of the internship, they gave me an offer to come back and work full-time. And then I got sponsored for an H-1B work petition to be in the U.S. and have a work visa in the U.S. and I've been here ever since. So the last 10 years I've been spending between the U.S. and Canada and making, you know, trips maybe once a year to see my family in Baghdad while they lived there until they moved out.
So your mother and brother are now refugees in Canada, and your family went through a horrific time during the war in Iraq. What was your experience there?
My family and I had undergone a series of tragedies and threats just, you know, by living there. It's kind of automatic that being there, you're exposed to the dangers and the violence of a war-torn life. So my father and brother were killed in a suicide bombing in Baghdad, and we had been displaced from our home when the sectarian violence broke out in Iraq. We'd received several threats. So, you know, the life we had back home had a lot of exposure to violence and terrorism. So, you know, people talk about having to do these changes here in order to stop terrorism and violence. And I don't think there's anybody that understands the impact of that than people like ourselves, people that are fleeing it. And we're coming here and we don't want that stuff anywhere near us. So I take as much of a serious interest in the security and the safety of this country as anybody else does. Maybe more, because I don't want any of the things that tore my family apart and threatened our lives back home to be anywhere near here. So when people often talk about national security and to excluding certain people and to protect the country, it almost sounds like they don't think that I or others that are speaking up against these changes also have that interest. Like, we don't care if this country burns down. But of course we do. If a bomb goes off here, it's going to affect me, whether by physically hurting me or affecting the other people that I love and care about. And I've experienced that firsthand, and I don't ever want to experience that, or anybody I care about here to experience that. So, you know, that part is always hard to process when people talk about it, because it just doesn't make sense, having gone through that and knowing how much it hurts. And that's why I've been trying to speak up against this, because I also see this as something that jeopardizes the safety and the security of the country, where it really offers a very convenient propaganda for groups like ISIS or Al-Qaeda that can say, look at what America's doing to our people. They're tearing our families apart. And this is a convenient message that we're just handing off to them by this change, and it serves their narrative and their recruiting stories. And so I don't see any good coming out of this.
So what do you think when you hear the president saying, oh, there's bad guys pouring in across the border, we need to make changes, you know, we need to stop these bad guys from coming in? Or what do you say to people who are just really afraid of terrorists coming through the borders of this country? I mean, what do you say?
Yeah, it sounds so silly when people talk about that, because you can't just enter the border, right? You have to get a visa to be able to even show up at the border, or board a plane that brings you to here. So getting a visa in itself is a lengthy process. I come and go on an almost weekly basis. In the last 2 years alone, I've crossed the border 50 times. And every time I come, at least two border officers are inspecting me, asking me questions, evaluating whether I am who I am, whether there is any threat of me entering the country. In fact, just yesterday I was coming into the country, and it took 4 hours for me to be cleared. And the officer, he was very kind about it, and he was apologetic. He said, sorry, we are holding you this long. We have to process this check that we're doing. And he said, we have to make sure that you're not a threat. And so, in a way, when people talk about terrorists pouring in, that's absurd. There is nobody pouring in. The concept of pouring in does not apply to border crossing. And maybe some people make that judgment about how easy it is to cross the border, either if they've never crossed the border and they don't know, or maybe they cross the border with an American passport, where, yes, it would be a breeze. But if you're an Iraqi, if you're an Iranian, you don't breeze through the border or the airport. You're subject to so much scrutiny and vetting already. If you read Section 3C of the executive order that introduces this ban, the justification for it is that to reduce the investigative burden on the agencies, they decided that they would stop all the admission and issuance of visas because it would be too much of a burden. And that part I agree with. When it takes 4 hours for me to be vetted at the border, where it's 4 hours of one officer's time, this is an officer that's sitting in front of a computer for 4 hours trying to vet that I'm a good guy to be let into the country. When I have been here for 10 years, I've had more than 10 U.S. visas. I work for Facebook. I have an H-1B, which is a really hard visa to get. And it takes 4 hours to tell that I'm not a terrorist. And if you think about that, this officer would have probably processed 50 passengers in those 4 hours, the ones that are, you know, regular passengers, the ones that don't require this vetting. In that sense, I agree that things need to change. And I can, for 1 second, I can see part of the logic about why they're saying, let's stop the admission of people in the country because it would be too much of a burden on the system. I mean, the answer is not to put a ban. The answer is to fix the system, because it really shouldn't be something that's this broken, where you're taking this long to be able to make these obvious decisions.
How does it feel to be sitting at an airport for 4 hours being subject to that kind of scrutiny as you're traveling about in your daily life?
Yeah, so I've always made that analogy of feeling kind of subhuman. Anytime that I travel, I feel like there's two lines that people stand in. There's the lines where the ordinary human beings go through, and that's kind of where people are looked at with kind of the benefit of the doubt, and it's like, oh, hey, you're coming to visit, welcome. And then that's the humans line. And then there's a subhumans line where that's where I stand, and that's where officers look with so much suspicion and scrutiny, and why are you coming here? Why are you visiting a friend? Why are you working here? Why do you live here? What? And that attitude of making you feel like you're lying, or that you don't even have a right to be here, which they say that sometimes. It's a privilege. You're not entitled to enter the country. And there is truth to that in the law. But just the attitude and the treatment, it has often left me feeling subhuman, like I don't have some of the basic rights of being a human being. And I remember joking with a friend who got citizenship a while ago and was naturalized. And he said, yeah, like, this is great. Now I feel like I'm a fully fledged human being. I can enjoy the benefits of being an ordinary human being. So that is indeed a feeling that is common to people in this position when entering through the border or the airports.
So the Trump administration wants to make it harder for people to come through the border. You know, you're subject to 4-hour inspections every time you pass. But at the same time, you want some changes in how the border operates.
Yeah.
What changes would you make? What do you want to see?
I don't understand the system on the inside to be able to propose changes. But just from the outside, I think the sharing of information. So, for example, when I apply for a visa, I give so much information to the government about my driver's license, my social security number, pretty much my entire life story. I submit it to the Department of State for the visa application, and then they review it and they do their own vetting, and then they approve the visa. Now, when I come through the border, an officer is asking me this information all over again, as if they've never had it before. Like, if the government was a Silicon Valley startup, this would never happen. You would not have a company where you have 4 hours of one person's time invested in something so inefficient that you could easily replace and automate and leverage technology to solve. And I hope that the government explores and invests in solutions that would help ease the burden and smoothen the process and make it also more secure, that things don't fall through the cracks, that when I come to the border, I don't need to give my social security number because they already have it. So there can't be mistakes. There can't be alterations in the way. So I think this is a win-win situation for both me as a passenger or as a traveler. It makes the travel time or the scrutiny time shorter. And it also makes the system more secure, where there is less vulnerabilities in it.
So the executive order is now on hold.
Yeah.
But, you know, who knows what's going to happen next? What's your life like now? I mean, you did go to Canada, but are you going to go travel around the world as you normally would be at this point?
I am suspending my longer-term travels, even going to Canada was something that I kind of did in a rush. I just went there Friday evening and came back Monday morning as early as I could, because there is that risk. Staying any longer increases the risk of not being able to come back. Things could change, you know, any minute without really any notice. So I'm not making any international trips to Africa or Asia where I would otherwise be going for work, because while I'm there, things could change quickly and I may not be able to come back. So it still affects that aspect of my life. And, you know, next weekend I would like to go to Canada, but I'm not sure I will, because we don't know how things are going to change this week. And if there is anticipated imminent changes, then it might be too risky to leave the country.
You have your family in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Given what's happening here politically, do you ever think, maybe I'll just join my family in Canada?
I do think about that, you know, especially the first time I started hearing about this change. And, you know, when the government is taking such an official and strong stance on rejecting people like myself, people who haven't done anything wrong and are here contributing to the economy and society, and it hurts. You know, it's not a very inviting attitude. It's discouraging. And it's tempting to start thinking, like, maybe I shouldn't be here anyway. If the government doesn't want me, like, why should I even try? And so that's certainly something I contemplate. But at the same time, these thoughts are easily offset by the support and the solidarity that people are expressing across the country. You know, you see people protesting this and saying, no, this is not what America is about. These are not American values. And so that reminds me, this is not a country that I want to give up on. This is not a country that is going to give up on people like myself. And that, you know, continuing to fight and continuing to speak up and remaining active about this will pay off. And that's what I hope to do, is to remain involved in sharing the story, dissolving the misconceptions and the fears. I can understand people's fears. You know, I came from a place where fear was a very prominent and regular aspect of our lives. And so I don't think people who are afraid are bad people or people that we should judge. I think we need to talk to them and we need to listen to each other and understand and say, look, it's okay. You don't have to be so afraid. It's okay to be afraid, and it's understandable. Some of the things happening in today's world are scary, but this is not the answer. And we need to work together on finding a better answer.
Murtada Al-Tamimi is a 24-year-old software engineer from Iraq. He works for Facebook here in Seattle, and you heard him talking there with KUOW's Deborah Wong. In other immigration news, some restaurants are closing tomorrow as their Latino employees participate in a Day Without Immigrants strike. We're going to cover that issue later today on KUOW's All Things Considered. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. There's a country that has immigrants sneaking across its southern border, and that country is Canada. We'll tell you about that in 10 minutes. First, let's enjoy some music, shall we? The senior editor at City Arts Magazine, Jonathan Zwickel, has some new local music for you. Jonathan, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What's the first song you got for us?
First song on my list is one called Scarfs. The song's called Crossroads Reconcile.
All right, let's listen.
You found the church, but I found the crossroads. You sold out, but I sold my soul.
You've said that there's a Northwest sound here.
Well, yeah, I do hear in the sort of song structure and the guitar work of this song a lot of similarities to the band Built to Spill. And Built to Spill, you know, is going on 20 plus years of touring and recording albums, sort of icons among Northwest indie rock royalty.
Oh, yeah.
And
from
I think
the 90s.
From the 90s, yeah, absolutely. Going back to the heyday of indie rock. And I think for a band like Scarves, that's probably, you know, one of the more iconic bands. You know, if you play sort of guitar-driven rock and roll, you can't help but be beholden to Doug March and Built to Spill and the things that they've done.
There is, even in the vocals, you could kind of hear it.
I think so. Yeah, it's that sort of boyish, really earnest, keening quality in his voice. You know, it's just got this really interesting sort of multi-part composition to it. And then really the guitars are also, you know, they start off really simple, but they slowly build and it sort of erupts into this really nice compositional moment at the peak of the song.
What kind of splash have the Scarves made in Seattle?
Yeah, I think they're a relatively young band, and I think maybe because they've also gone through a few lineup changes, there's been, you know, they have yet to really gain serious traction here. But with this album, I could see them actually, you know, making a splash. I know that they're playing out over the next couple months and to celebrate the release of the album. So, yeah, keep an eye out.
The album is?
It's called Mall Goths.
Mall Goths.
Yeah.
Our next artist, Jonathan, I'm not sure how to pronounce it. Control Model?
It is Control Model.
Hey, yeah. How about that? Tell us about them.
Well, it's one guy, actually. His name is AJ Swan, and he's a classically trained musician, went to UW, studied in the music school here. He's a deep, deep nerd when it comes to vintage synthesizers and drum machines, sort of analog synthesizers made in the early 80s. And you can hear that in this song here. And all of the song titles on this album, Wholesale Memories, are sort of written almost in computer code.
Uh-huh.
Sort of like the band name. I mean, Control Model, but you might not know just by looking at the text that that's what the band is called.
Control, CTRL is in the control key.
Right, and MOD-L.
Yeah.
But this song, I guess, Gunwing Pegasus.us is what we'll call it, because that's how it reads. There's a particular quality to the tones that these instruments make that I think back then sounded kind of novel or almost goofy. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, 80s music kind of has a like a corny, cheesy quality to it because of the tone of these instruments.
Yes.
You know, or at least it did. I think these days people are starting to appreciate that sound, right? I mean, these are analog synthesizers. It's not, the sounds aren't digital. They're actually analog produced sounds. They're vibrations that are creating these sounds. And so there's something really warm and really almost palpable about the sounds that you get out of these synths and drum machines and sequencers and stuff. And Adam is just, or AJ is just a master of using those machines to create really warm sounding music. So it's all, you know, it's all sort of machine made, but at the same time it has a very warm, very human quality to it. It does have that sort of slow building classic techno build to it, or drama to it. You know, it's a 5-6 minute long song that is beautifully repetitive. I mean, it definitely has this sort of hypnotic repetitive quality to it, which I find really compelling. And over the span of several minutes, it builds and it builds until you get this sort of verbal exhortation to make people dance, basically. And then it's like this great crescendo at that moment.
Do you want to dance? Come on and dance with this old school.
You know, you listen to this whole album and it's just shot through with texture and layers. And especially if you listen with headphones on, you'll start picking up all of these tiny little details, you know, deep, deep in the mix that make for a really interesting listen. It's kind of hilarious, right? I mean, you put it on, you listen in the car, and it's one thing, but then if you listen at home with headphones on, you'll start picking up on all these details that you didn't realize were there, and there's just something really fun about that.
All right, Jonathan, you got one last song for us. This is called Christine, and it's by Solitaire. This sounds like the easygoing hits of my 70s childhood.
It definitely has that sort of late 70s FM radio vibe, you know? And it reminds me so much of roller skating. It's just that really easy, kind of like slick guitar riff. And the song itself is so catchy. I mean, it's so buoyant and bubbly. It it does seem like sort of a shot of summertime in deep winter, which is maybe why I was so turned on to it, because, you know, it just felt like a little respite from the dark days that we've been having.
A shot of summertime, even though Solitaire is not from SoCal, he's from north of us.
Yeah, he's from Vancouver, is my understanding. This guy named Adam Wozonik, who is super prolific with releasing recordings on SoundCloud, which is sort of its own purview unto itself. You know, there are these musicians who record in their bedroom or on their laptop and release music directly to their SoundCloud accounts.
He doesn't have any CDs.
To my understanding, no. Uh-huh. I mean, he might, but I haven't encountered any of them. I've only found his music online. And he's got, you know, this song on SoundCloud has 20-some thousand plays on it. So I'm not the only one. You know, whatever type of music you're into, classic rock, hip-hop, R&B, this weirder synth stuff, there is a really deep, deep well for that kind of stuff here. All of that is being made here in Seattle, and it's also really, really good. You know, that's, to me, the most notable thing about it, is not just the diversity and the range, but it's also how good a lot of this stuff is. I mean, I think a lot of us, we sort of depend on New York or California to be the funnels for culture into our lives, and, you know, on a mainstream basis, I think that's fine. But if you're more interested in the stuff that is happening in your backyard, you can know with certainty that Seattle is making whatever kind of music you're into and making it really, really well.
You can find it.
Yeah.
Should we listen to some more of this Solitaire song, Christine?
Yeah, let's go for it.
We'll mellow out together.
Right.
Jonathan Zwickel is senior editor at the City Arts magazine. We're tweeting out a link to Zwickel's Attractive Singles article, his monthly list of can't-miss local music. So join us on Twitter at KUOW. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us today. My next guest says if Canada had a word of the week, it would be tweak. Stephen Quinn is host of CBC Radio's On the Coast. Welcome back, Stephen.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. So Canada's prime minister and the American president met this week, and it sounds like Canada is relieved. Is that still true?
I think so. The consensus seems to be that the Prime Minister's meeting with Donald Trump was reassuring to the business community. There is, though, a lot of consternation about that word, exactly what President Trump meant when he said tweaking the NAFTA. So lots of speculation about what that means. The Prime Minister was asked about it repeatedly yesterday. He did not offer any theories on what he thought tweaking might mean exactly. It is, I think, generally seen as positive. It's kind of a reassurance that as far as Canada goes, the United States isn't going to be looking for any wholesale change to NAFTA. It's been suggested by Canadian officials that President Trump used that word because officials on your side of the border don't really know what it means either, and they just wanted Donald Trump to be vague about it. So the indication from this side is U.S. negotiators don't really have a plan yet.
Yes, it seems like the president is looking south more than north right now.
Well, that's it. And there's a lot of questions about how a three-way trade agreement could favor one partner so much more than another. So, you know, Mexico, I think a lot of this isn't going to fly with Mexico if Canada is seen to get special treatment.
Meanwhile, it sounds like Canada is going after its own free trade deals.
Yeah, news this morning that, and this has been a long time being negotiated, about 7 years being negotiated, a trade deal with the European Union. That was approved, or news of it came out this morning that it had been approved. It's known as CETA. 7 years in the making. It was almost scuttled by Wallonia. Which is a
is
small,
right?
Yes, which is, for people who don't know, it's a small region in Belgium. They could have killed the deal, but late last year, Canada sent a trade team over to placate the Wallonians, and it's all fine now. The EU is Canada's second largest trading partner after the U.S., but we're talking about very different scales here. I mean, about 75% of our goods go to the U.S., about 10% goes to the European market. So, but this is going to mean that about 98% of tariffs tariffs are dropped between those European countries and Canada. So it is a very free trade on both sides of the deal. And it's supposed to increase trade on this end with Europe by about 20%. And some study has come out to say that means about the equivalent of about 80,000 jobs here in Canada.
Okay, thank the Walloons. Now that's trade.
Yes.
Let's talk immigration for a moment, because Trudeau was pretty nice to Trump. He said, the last thing Canadians want is for me to lecture another country on how they should govern. Is that right? Is that the last thing Canadians wanted out of this?
No, that is not the last thing Canadians want. Canadians would very much like to see Trudeau lecture Donald Trump on what to do about immigration. The ban on immigrants and refugees from majority Muslim countries, it is not sitting well with Canadians, especially, you know, when Canada has been so open to accepting, what, more than 30,000 Syrian refugees in just over the past year. Members of the opposition have called the American policy, or the policy that Donald Trump would love to ram through, they've just said it's outright racism. And they said that Trudeau's meeting with Trump was an opportunity for him to denounce it. He didn't do that. Instead, he made nice, kept his mouth shut, you know, behaved in a typically Canadian fashion. And the same goes for environmentalists as well. You know, they thought this was an opportunity for Trudeau to say something about the direction the U.S. appears to be going when it comes to climate change, which may or may not exist, according to your president. And again, nothing from the prime minister was said.
Finally, we just have about a minute left or so. There's a country that has immigrants sneaking across its southern border, and that country is Canada. Will you tell us about this?
This is fascinating, and this is happening mostly in the province of Manitoba, where by night, dozens of refugees are making their way from the United States through to Canada, and really taking their lives into their hands to do it, crossing miles and miles of just frozen farm fields, basically. We have this agreement with the United States called a Safe Third Country Agreement. So if you want to seek asylum in Canada, and you do it at a regular border crossing, because you're coming from the United States, which is considered a safe country, you have to make your claim there. That's not so. There's a weird loophole in this. That's not so when you cross an unguarded part of the border. And so we've seen in just last week about two dozen people, whole families of refugees. And these are people who have made their way through the United States, a lot of them through Central America and Mexico, but they're from places like Ghana and Ethiopia and Somalia. And there's talk now of scrapping the Safe Third Country Agreement. That's what a lot of people would like to see. So these refugees aren't sent back if they arrive at a regular border crossing on land, rather than taking their lives into their hands. So it really is an ongoing story, but the numbers are increasing, and there are some harrowing, harrowing tales of people suffering terrible frostbite to get here.
Fascinating. We'll keep watching that, Stephen Quinn, host of CBC's CBC Radio's On the Coast. It's good to talk with you again.
Good to talk with you, Bill.
It's KUOW's The Record.